magistrate, the interpreter, the police constables, to say nothing of the public gallery. All he needed to do was to turn round and look, and there's almost a flare-up of enthusiasm around him.
He upset prosecutors, policemen, and magistrates for not being subservient, particularly when he cross-examined whites. Women would be absolutely shocked that an African could stand up and ask them questions.
I once heard a case of rape where a black man had raped a white woman. One of the essential points of the charge in rape is that there should have been penetration. So when I cross-examined her on this, for her in a court of law, in the presence of black clients, to admit that there was penetration was something too serious, too humiliating. And she said, no. I said, but are you saying that your statement that you gave to the police was wrong? Are you saying that there was no penetration? He says, there was no penetration. And of course, that was the essence of the case.
In 1955, the ANC put out a call to opposition groups of all races from all over the country. They came together to approve the Freedom Charter. The charter spelled out the demands for the creation of a free, democratic, and multiracial South Africa. Mandela, one of the key organizers of the event, had been prohibited by the police from attending any public gatherings. He watched secretly from the sidelines.
He could do anything for the politics. The family comes second, but the politics comes first.
He was hardly ever around. He was organizing. In those days, you didn't travel by planes, when you were organizing the ANC, you travel by whatever lift you could get, or you travel by bus, or you travel by train. So you were away from home all that much longer.
Sometimes you would go home and come back in the early hours of the morning. And when I asked him, where have you been? No, I have no policeman in the house to ask where I've been. Can't ask me that. So, all right, I kept quiet.
Evelyn herself didn't think that the marriage was ending, although they had separated and she was living in one part of Orlando and he was living in another part of Orlando. She was still hopeful that they would get together.
You must part. See, Evelyn, I feel that I have no love for you anymore. I'll give your children and the house. And I said, no, I'm not going to agree to that. So I want to punish that. I don't want the divorce.
In 1957, Mandela divorced Evelyn, leaving their three children in her custody.
I remember the first time my mother came to Johannesburg. Two white policemen went home whilst I was at work, and they could speak Xhosa very well. And they said to her, look, Mom, we have come to warn you. Ask your son to go back home to the Transkei. He is getting into trouble. He has already been in jail. And he will die in jail. He at least has got a profession. I just turned qualified as a lawyer. Has got a profession. He is mixing up with people who have no professions. Mischief makers, agitators. We have nothing to lose. Tell your son to go back home and assume his position. By the time I returned in the afternoon, my mother was waiting for me at the gate. And she says, you must go home. You can't be getting in and out of prison. That's a disgrace. There were two whites here and who spoke very well like parents. And they say, I must send you home. So I realized that I must start at home by preaching politics.
Well, he was strikingly handsome. And in those days, he didn't have this lean figure. He was a big man. And the first thing that attracted you to him was his physical presence, which was so very attractive. Then, of course, he had a sense of humor, and he pulled your legs, you know. I mean, he cracked jokes, and he teased, you see. So there was that part. So you fell into a very easy relationship with him.
I can remember, yes, it was yesterday, this tall, elegant, very well-dressed young man who entertained lavishly, didn't drink, but would have a cupboard full of liquor at a time when a black required a permit to buy white man's liquor, and would be entertaining his friends, plying them with alcohol, while he never touched the town stuff.
I got this phone call. This man said, a very stern voice said, is that Miss Madikizela? I said, yes, sir. And then he said, you may not recall seeing me, but I am the person who usually picks up Dr. M.G. at that bus stop where you wait for your bus. Then he told me his name. He wanted to see me. I tried to avoid the meeting, and he is, of course, very persistent, and he has the type of voice you can't say no to. When he asks you for a favor, he is, in fact, giving you a command in a very polite way, so... He was giving me this command to meet him, and the trembling little girl, of course, I said, yes, sir. My father was totally opposed to the wedding. He was worried about my age. He was worried about the fact that Mandela was so involved politically. The family elders felt that he was marrying me just as a maid to look after his children, because he would spend the rest of his life in prison. And he had children by his first marriage. So they thought that he just wanted someone to look after those children. Which, of course, I totally disagreed with. We were madly in love.
The treason trial I'll always remember as having something horrific about it. It was very Kafkaesque and alarming. I was amazed by the courage of all the accused, whether it was Tambo, Mandela or Sisulu, because they were so obviously being trapped and caught into this nightmarish procedure, which was designed, of course, specifically to keep them out of politics, to keep them tied up.
In Johannesburg itself, where the preparatory examination took place, it actually aroused the enthusiasm of our people.
The solidarity, which was increasing almost every day, you could see it. And there, I remember noticing somehow the the tall shape of Mandela was so often seen to be as a focus for the others. The command and authority and respect, you could see this leadership sort of changing shape.
Mandela had become a central figure in the trial. His law practice and his family life suffered. He spent less and less time at home with Winnie and their two daughters, who were born during this period.
He would leave me at home every morning and go to the treason trial. If he came back home once a week, we were lucky. We were lucky to see him at all. And when he did come home, he would be going to these meetings, and we were lucky if he came home at 4 o'clock in the morning to be up on the road again to the treason trial in Pretoria.
Day after day, the same people had to come in, endure this day, and then it was a succession of detailed and minor accusations which then went through this cross-examination revealing the police had all been lying.
The government's case collapsed, and all the accused were found not guilty. For 4.5 years, opposition leaders had been tied up by the trial, but in the streets and in the black ghettos, resistance had continued.
It was felt that somebody should go underground and lead the movement. I accepted the challenge with all its difficulties.
The whole country, police, army, everyone had a photograph of Nelson Mandela, who had to be arrested immediately he was seen.
We couldn't really disguise his face. I mean, he'd wear a cap or something from time to time. But it was never satisfactory. We had to take great precautions. We had to blindfold journalists. We had to change cars, sometimes 2 or 3 cars.
Do you see Africans being able to develop in this country without the European being pushed out?
South Africa is a country of many races. There is room for all the various races in this country. The Africans want one man, one vote. They want political independence.
Now, if Dr. Verwoerd's government doesn't give you the kind of concessions that you want sometime soon, is there any likelihood of violence?
It is useless and futile for us to continue talking peace and non-violence against a government whose reply is only savage attacks on an unarmed and defenseless people.
In that situation, we had no alternative but to resort to armed struggle. But we made it clear, even as we took that decision, that the responsibility rested squarely on the shoulders of the government. and that we could refrain from this action even at this 11th hour if the government agreed to meet and to sit down with us. But the government believed in strong arm methods, and all that they did was to say gloves off. There is now going to be a real conflict. We are going to suppress you. And that's what they tried to do.
Mandela left the country on a mission to raise funds and get military training for the armed struggle. Upon his return to South Africa, he was caught and arrested.
I must just tell you about his dramatic appearance in court. My word. I was sitting in the court because I was reporting it. Special branch, armed policemen, outside the court, inside the court, thousands of people. Then Winnie came with the suitcase, and she said to the policeman, before the court had started, take this down as a change of clothing for Mr. Mandela. This man walked up, and as I say, he was a mighty man, you know. He had beads around his neck. He had a sort of cross over here. He had things around his national dress. Everyone was just shocked at seeing this man in this dramatic attire. And he looked straight at that magistrate. The magistrate was transfixed by this just staring of Mandela, like a mongoose with a snake.
Mandela was sentenced to 5 years for leaving the country illegally and inciting strikes. While he was in prison, his comrades in the armed struggle were arrested. They were found with guns, bombs, and documents that incriminated Mandela. Less than a year into his sentence, he was back in court, this time facing the death penalty for high treason.
You know, we were even warned by the lawyers in this case that don't be hopeful. This is a bad case for us. The things that were on that table, different types of arms, the lawyers were so scared. They said, look, these people are caught red-handed.
My wife came before the sentence. And he said, well, look, you have to be strong. I said, that was a reflection of how they were thinking outside.
We were prepared for anything. And because the lawyers were now shaky, we said, they are going to hang. But we will be there with them.
We were concerned that in seeking to defend ourselves in court, we shouldn't say anything that would distort the history of the struggle.
The very speech which was made by Nelson consolidated the spirit of the people outside, because it was a defiant spirit.
He said that democracy and non-racialism were things that he had fought for all his life. And in the first draft, he had said that he was prepared to die for it. In discussions, we persuaded him to add three words so that it may not be as challenging as the first draft. The words were, if needs be, I am prepared to die for it. It's the one amendment that he did accept. But when he uttered those words, there was a gasp and then absolute silence.
You know, it became dark in court. You know, we didn't even know that the clouds are gathering. It became dark and the rain just fell. And it was all quiet. After that, some of us said, those are the last words he is giving us.
I have fought against white domination. And I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunity. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and to achieve. But if need be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.
I have fought against white domination and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and achieve. But if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die. Now, this documentary film, it's a full-length, two-hour documentary film on the life of Nelson Mandela, and much of it is narrated by Nelson Mandela himself. Now, in the past 10 minutes or so, you are hearing extensively a narration from Walter Sisulu, and his wife, Albertina Sisulu, who, of course, were also co-activists along with Nelson Mandela and principal figures in the African National Congress. And this is a documentary that we are presenting this afternoon because we think that this is an apposite moment to reflect upon the significance of the life and legacy of Nelson Mandela. This week marks the 19th anniversary of Mandela's accession to the presidency of South Africa on May 10th of 1994. And I thought that this would be an ideal opportunity for us to take another look at the life of Nelson Mandela. And also, not just a superficial look, but to go all the way back to Mandela's childhood, his early years, his early education, and take a look at all of the forces of history that came together to produce this remarkable and transcendental figure in 20th century history. And I say 20th century history because, of course, we are well into the 21st century. Mr. Mandela is now 94 years old, not doing so well, but continuing to be a source of tremendous inspiration internationally and a global figure, a figure of such global dominance, a figure of such global significance that just in recent weeks, when we heard that he was not doing so well, the entire international community pretty much sat up and took very serious notice. Now, this documentary is remarkable for several reasons. One, it is the most expansive and the most thorough and the most in-depth treatment in this medium that I know of on the life of Nelson Mandela. And that alone recommends it very highly as an important and necessary addition to your library. Also, it is a documentary that, as I mentioned, is largely narrated by Nelson Mandela himself. So you know that it is a documentary of which he has approved. Otherwise, he would not have lent his voice. And he has approved in its treatment of his life and work. But in addition to that, the documentary on DVD comes along with a CD with the complete soundtrack. It also comes along with a 46-page full-color booklet containing both a narrative and full-color photographs, glossy photographs, reflecting significant moments in the and highlights in the history of the anti-apartheid struggle and in the life of Nelson Mandela. And in addition to that, it also comes with a special edition map of South Africa and the life of Nelson Mandela issued by National Geographic. This is a 21 by 30 inch wall map. You can mount it on your wall, or you could just simply keep it as part of the package together. It's a wonderful souvenir, and it's also a great visual aid to help you to understand how the struggle against apartheid migrated to various parts of the country. And in addition to the geography that is here on the displayed on the map, there are also very significant archival photographs of various points in the life of Nelson Mandela, as well as photographs of other significant anti-apartheid ambassadors and leaders and activists, including musicians like Hugh Masekela. So this package, the entire package, is available as a thank you gift to you with your pledge at the $100 level this afternoon. So that's a $100 tax-deductible contribution to WBAI. With that contribution, you get the Mandela set with the DVD, the CD of the DVD of the documentary film, the two-hour documentary film. There's a CD as well in the package of the soundtrack. There's also the 4-to-6-page booklet, and there is also this map, this special edition map from National Geographic on the life of Nelson Mandela and South Africa. So all of that is available as a thank you gift with your pledge at the $100 level. We ask you to call 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. We're going to give you some dialing music in a moment. 516-620-3602. And we ask you to go to the phones right now to join those who already have done so and make a pledge of support. This is WBAI New York, where it is now 5 o'clock. Usually at this time, you would be listening to the opening strains of the introduction to the 5 o'clock shadow. The 5 o'clock shadow is going to be here tomorrow. We have the benefit of an additional hour in order for us to maximize the value and impact of our presence and our presentation here this afternoon. There's more of this documentary film that we'd like to share with you, and I specifically requested an expanded edition of the program today so that we could share as much of the documentary as is possible. But of course, it's a two-hour work. It's a monumental work. 2 hours long. We're not going to be able to give you all of it, but we'll give you as much of it as it is possible to fit into this period of time. We have the benefit of an additional hour. But remember, this is also a fundraising edition of the program Talk Back. And so we ask you now to go to your phones, 516-620-3602. This is the opening day one of our spring membership and fundraising drive for 2013. And we hope that this afternoon you will not walk but run to the telephones, and that you will make generous and abundant tax-deductible contributions to WBAI this afternoon to get us off to a flying start. And also that with the benefit of your contributions this afternoon, we will be sending an important message that WBAI remains a powerful force to be reckoned with on the media landscape here in the city of New York, in the New York tri-state area, and internationally, as you're listening to us online at WBAI.org. There is also the option of making your contribution online. You can go to our donation site, which is give2wbai.org, or if you're listening to us online right now, from where you are right now on our regular homepage, on the homepage there's a link that takes you to the donation site where you can make your tax-deductible contribution to WBAI. So here's some dialing music for you at 2 minutes after the hour. The number 516-620-3602, and we thank you very much for your support. 516-620-3602. Yeah, that's, of course, Hugh Masekela. And Hugh Masekela's music is a very important, a very critical part of the soundtrack of this documentary film. But so, too, are so many other remarkable South African performers and musicians. And this is, it's a great opportunity as well for you to reacquaint yourself with some of the music of South Africa going all the way back to the 1940s. Because, you know, South African music has evolved in so many ways and in so many directions. It's such a complex music. It's such a diverse music as well. And it is a music with so many influences. And you know, the thing about this is that Nelson Mandela himself, when Mandela went to Britain after he was released from prison, and this, in fact, just let me find the notes here from the booklet, because remember I told you there's this 46-page booklet. Well, the booklet has is chock full of information, narrative information, as well as these wonderful pictures. And there was a notation here about Nelson Mandela's relationship to music, and the fact that he credits music with having done so much to make the anti-apartheid struggle a success. They point out in the book that the first internationally, move forward to the fact that let's run through this. There are mentions here of notable South African musicians like Lucky Dube and Machlatini and the Mahotela Queens. There is, of course, that's Ladysmith Black Mambazo, and so on.
This music is so important, and,
yes,
and particularly Hugh Masekela, important in our lives. You realize,
yes,
that here in the United States, it was important to our lives. And Hugh Masekela is so much more, as we know now, having lived through this period, than grazing in the grass. And you know,
yes,
something? This radio station was particularly important in sharing that music and having that music in the forefront. It was a part of the ongoing soundtrack during the 1980s and during the 1990s. Do you realize that? That's how important WBAI is. And I want to thank you, those of you who have called in your pledges of support for Talk Back this afternoon with Hugh Hamilton. And we want the rest of you who are listening to us right now, who are listening to Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton, to make that call. 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602.
And thank you very much, Michael G. Haskins. You know, you see, this is what makes this thing work so well here. This partnership between Michael G. Haskins and me here Monday through Thursday on Talk Back. Because as I was trying to find my way through this booklet and getting increasingly lost in the narrative, and there it was that Michael G. was able to step in and to articulate very eloquently consequently precisely the point that needed to be made here about the significance of that music. Let's listen to some of that music, and when we return, I'm going to tell you just a little bit more about Mandela's relationship to music and his acknowledgement and recognition of the value of the music of South Africa as the soundtrack of the anti-apartheid struggle. But in the meantime, please continue to go to your phones, 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. Your $100 pledge gets you this Mandela set, beautiful Mandela, son of Africa, father of a nation. All right. Isn't that so beautiful, so moving? We're going to return to more of this documentary, Mandela, son of Africa, father of a nation. But I found that paragraph in this booklet. It's a 46-page, beautiful booklet with a narrative and very glossy, high-colored and full-colored photographs depicting various aspects of the anti-apartheid struggle, as well as some archival photographs and some contemporary photographs of South Africa. And part of the in a section of the booklet, of this booklet that comes along with the DVD of the film and the CD of the soundtrack, the booklet points out that Mandela loved music and was perhaps unique among global statesmen in realizing how it could have an important political impact. In April of 1990, on his first visit to Britain after 27 years in jail, his first appearance was not at a meeting of activists or politicians, but at an epic pop show in his honour at London's Wembley Stadium, watched by a television audience of hundreds of millions around the world. Mandela was well aware that a similar concert held at the same venue just 18 months earlier had helped to transform his image and perhaps had sped his release from prison. On June 11th of 1988, a television audience of some 600 million people in 67 countries had watched the Nelson Mandela 70th birthday tribute at a time when the South African authorities still tried to portray him as a terrorist rather than a wrongly jailed world leader. The all-star cast included Stevie Wonder, Hugh Masekela, Dire Straits, Eurythmics, and of course Jerry Dammers of the Specials singing his anthem, Nelson Mandela. It was an extraordinary event and echoed the role that music had played in the anti-apartheid movement. South African stars like Miriam Makeba and Hugh Masekela had started the campaign back in the late 50s and 60s after managing to leave South Africa for the USA. There they used their fame as musicians to highlight the increasingly desperate situation of those who had left behind in South Africa's townships. Miriam Makeba was in fact Africa's first musical superstar, and they go on to talk about some of the ways in which these musical superstars of South Africa became emissaries and ambassadors to the rest of the world of the anti-apartheid struggle. So you see, this was a struggle that was being waged on many fronts, and all of that is part of this remarkable, full-length and compelling two-hour documentary film, Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation, and it's available to you as a thank you gift right now, this afternoon, when you call 516-620-3602. Let me say that slowly, 516-620-3602. It's available to you right now. Please call that number and join those who already have called and who are doing so even as we speak. There is an almost unlimited capacity to receive these calls at the call center, I'm told. So you're not constrained by a limitation in the number of lines, like one line or two lines or whatever it is. They can take 20 of these calls all at once, 25, two dozen of the calls all at once. So please join those. There is a lot of capacity there, and we want to use it all up, because it is so important that we make a strong and powerful statement here this afternoon. Remember that you can make a pledge at any level that is comfortable and convenient for you. Your $25, $35, $50, $75 pledge are very welcome, and we thank you for that support at that level. You can also join us at the $500 pledge level, the $5,000 pledge level. Maybe you can send us a matching pledge, or a pledge that becomes a matching grant to this radio program and to this radio station. The number is 516-620-3602. And at your $100 pledge level or bet or higher, you have the option. We'd be very pleased to send you this documentary film as a thank you gift. Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation. Please ask for the Mandela set. You get the entire package. It's the DVD of the two-hour documentary together with the CD of the soundtrack, as well as the 46-page full-color glossy booklet that includes both a narrative on the life of Nelson Mandela, as well as archival and contemporary photographs highlighting various aspects of the history of the anti-apartheid struggle and the life of Mandela. And you also get, as part of this very package, this special edition National Geographic map of South Africa, titled The Life of Nelson Mandela, highlighting locations in South Africa where Mandela has lived and that were significant milestones in his continuing South African journey, and also including full color photographs of Mandela and a number of other notable figures in the anti-apartheid struggle. So all of that is part of this package, and it's all available as a thank you gift with your pledge at the $100 level. Now, it doesn't get any better than that. I would really love it if this afternoon we could walk out of here knowing that we have made that we've had a minimum of 100 pledges for this package here this afternoon. That's what I would really like to have. And I think there is still time for us to achieve that. We are not as far along, I am told, as I would have liked us to be. And I know that on the first day of the drive, sometimes we are not off to as sprightly a start as I would prefer. But I believe that today could be different. In fact, I believe that today is different, because today is not like any other day. Today is a brand new day that gives us a brand new opportunity to set a brand new standard. And I'm asking you to work with me and to work with Michael G. Haskins here this afternoon to make that statement, to make that point. Because when you make that pledge this afternoon, when you call this afternoon and make a pledge of support at whatever is the comfortable level for you, you're sending a very clear and powerful and very potent message that this program matters, that you care about this program, that you want this program to remain here, that you are standing here in defense of this program, that you are part of the community that it constitutes TalkBack. You're part of the TalkBack family and community, and that you have a stake in this program. You're making all of these statements. It is as much a financial commitment as it is a political statement. When you call right now, this afternoon, before this program is over in 45 minutes, within the next 45 minutes, we need to get another 50 calls within the next 45 minutes in order for us to make the kind of statement I would like us to make. And that should be eminently doable. That is something that should not be any heavy lifting. I'm not asking every person who is listening to us right now to make that call. Why? Because I know that that is not going to happen. Now, I should, in theory, say that every person should make the call, knowing that there's some are not going to be able to. There's some who wouldn't be able to afford to make the call. And there's some who are not in a position physically right now to make that call, and so on. I understand that. But I'm asking you. I'm asking you to step up and to take that responsibility. You are the person I'm talking to. I'm just asking you to make that call. Never mind everybody else. The other people will take care of themselves. You, I'm asking, please go to the phones right now and make that call. 516-620-3602. Repeat, 516-620-3602. And remember, I'm not here tomorrow. When we're done here this afternoon at 6, I'm not here again until next week. So I really would like to be able to walk out of this door this afternoon with our heads held high. Michael G. Haskins and I are very excited about being able to offer this premium here this afternoon, this thank you gift to you, and also to use to provide these extended excerpts as we prepare to observe, to note, to commemorate, to celebrate, to take note of, to remember this 19th anniversary of the accession of Nelson Mandela to this presidency of South Africa. That anniversary comes up on Friday. That's Friday, May 10th is the 19th anniversary. This is a great time, I think, to remember and to pay tribute to the life and work and accomplishments and example of Nelson Mandela. So let's return now to more of the documentary film. And while the presentation is in progress, please continue to call 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. And we thank you very much for your support.
Comrades were sentenced to life on Robben Island, a notorious prison off the coast of Cape Town.
I believe the way in which you'll be treated by the prison authorities depends on your demeanor. And you must fight that battle and win it on the very first day. Two chaps came through the passage, and they're very aggressive. And they selected Molete, who was a gentleman, you know, very soft, very courteous chap. And this captain says, "Why is your hair so long? Don't you know the regulations?" And Molete, you know, couldn't handle such an aggressive approach. And he says, "Your hair is long, like this boy's," pointing at me. And I say, "Look here," I couldn't finish that sentence. When he dashed, charged on me, against me, and I said to him, "You dare touch me, I will take you to the highest court in the land. And by the time I finish with you, you will be as poor as a church mouse." That stopped him on his tracks.
They had indoctrinated these chaps very, very thoroughly. Everyone was frightened of us. You know, they had painted a picture of wild, unruly, undisciplined, violent terrorists. So that for the first month, while we were in our cells, locked up, now our cells had windows leading into the passage, they'd brought warders from many prisons throughout South Africa. And they'd walk down the passage, stand at the cells, and stare at us like animals in the zoo.
Some warders questioned, must we be so cruel to people whose only crime is to want justice, equality? And others say, no, we should treat them harshly so that when they go out, they will know that the white man is the boss. And the others say, no, the lesson of history is that these people eventually win. And if we treat them like this, that is how they will treat us when they come into power.
Their task was to break our morale. Visits and letters once in 6 months. One letter, one visit.
My darling Winnie, your visit last month was quite unexpected. And that might be one reason I enjoyed it so much. The mere sight of you kindles a thousand fires in me. Your beautiful photo still stands above my left shoulder as I write this note. I dust it carefully every morning, for to do so gives me the pleasant feeling that I'm caressing you as in the old days. I even touch your nose with mine to recapture the electric current that used to flush through my blood whenever I did so.
In January of 65, they took us out to the lime quarry. Now, we were addressed by the Commissioner of Prisons, General Steyn. He called us all together and said, look, this work will last for about 6 months, and then we're going to give you soft labor. That lime quarry work, I think, lasted for about 13 years.
The work itself, which was very difficult, of course, kept you fit. You would stand on top there and started digging. And then it gradually comes down. And that is why you see these lines. As you break that platform, then the level gradually comes down until you come right down here.
When they took us to the quarry to go and dig lime, by the end of the day, our hands were bleeding. We had not, of course, been accustomed to work with pick and shovel.
We had no toilet facilities. We went into that tunnel for toilet facilities. And you dug a hole and you closed it. And sometimes you dug a hole and you found that somebody had sat there, you see. It was a messy affair.
So when you were at the quarry face, the warders would count us every half an hour, every three-quarter of an hour. They count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. If they are not 30 prisoners, out comes the dogs.
They would decide before we leave the prison. They say, now today we want to punish so-and-so. We want to punish Neville Alexander and Magwetu. And it did not matter how hard they worked that day. At the end of the day, the warder would say, Magwetu, Neville, Alexander, I want you to appear before the head of the prison for refusing to work. And people become punished.
Sad melodies coming out like a smoke from the woody fire.
Africa, sing loud, sing to the people.
He stood his ground firmly to expose the jail conditions to visiting people like judges, magistrates, or visitors from wherever.
We got into prison in 72, and what we did during that period within a year appeared too radical for most of the prisoners on Robben Island.
We still had illusions about coming out after 2 years, being liberated by the victorious revolution and all the rest of it, and therefore, you know, really giving them hell inside while our comrades outside were doing their thing.
Through prison grapevine, we knew that Nelson is making the representations. He's the person that negotiates with the prison authorities and all that. They said, wow, if Nelson was doing all this, how come we're in such shit?
We had to be put straight by the Mandelas, who were older people, first of all. Secondly, had been in prison before and gone through hell in the 50s already with the Defiance Campaign and all that, and knew what prison really means in South Africa. And we didn't know. I mean, none of us had ever been in a prison.
We used to play chess on Robben Island. And Nelson wasn't one of the greater players. He would take days, I'm not exaggerating, 3 days, 4 days to finish a single game. No, but that's part of the man's makeup. Sometimes he becomes very inscrutable. He's slow and very smart, very adept. He can listen to you, work out in his own mind, and do things.
We encouraged all our chefs to study. And we also acted as teachers at work. We had no blackboards, we had no paper. We used the sand.
Somebody would have prepared a lesson the night before. And as we worked, you see, he would then lecture to the others on what he read. And they would discuss the lecture.
For days on end, debates would go on. And that's true, you know, sometimes you say that debates go on for 30 days, 40 days. Time was not a problem in that sense. But yet, on the other hand, we would not waste 3 minutes doing nothing. If you wanted to talk to me about something, I say, okay, let's make a time. We couldn't say 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock before lunch or after lunch or after breakfast. But the point is that all of us operated, and this was true, as if time was running out.
My mother had struggled, and I was able to support her for some time when I was now practicing as a lawyer. I was arrested. She struggled again, and she came to see me several times. And the last time she came to see me, I could see that she was going. In fact, you know, as she was leaving for the dock, I turned around and I looked at her. And the way she was walking, I felt that that was the last time I had seen her. And her death was one of the saddest moments I heard.
Nelson is a person who doesn't share his grief. He likes to keep his grief to himself. It's like pulling his blanket tight over his body. And he just like this, you know.
They were harassing my wife, and we were not getting any newspapers. Whenever my wife was arrested, then they cut out and made a cutting and just left it on my table as I was away at work. And I come back and I see my wife has been arrested.
My darling Winnie, our daughters raised in hardship are grown women today. The firstborn has her own house and is raising a family. I had hoped to build you a refuge, no matter how small, so that we would have a place for rest and sustenance before the arrival of the sad, dry days. I fell down and couldn't do these things. I am as one building castles in the air.
One of the dreams I constantly had in prison was me going home and getting out in the middle of the city and having to walk from town to Soweto and reaching home, finding that the house was open, that there was nobody at home, and being concerned as to what has happened to women and the children.
One morning, there was the usual bang on all the doors, and I thought I was being arrested as usual. I was told to follow them to the trucks, and then we were driven to the Free State. We were taken to this house in Brantford. There wasn't even a floor, and there I was expected to live.
She lived in a small, miserable, four-roomed house in an area where everybody spoke Sesotho. No one understood Xhosa. I suppose this is why she was banned to this area. But she was beginning to grow a vegetable garden. She was starting women's self-help groups, beginning to really interact and work with the local community.
In Brantford, I would either have been totally broken or survived. And I decided to survive.
Leaders inside prison who share with you the pain of our country. The solution to this country's problem lies in this black hand. That day is not far when we shall lead you to freedom. Amanda!
One man, one vote in South Africa?
No.
Isn't that why you are almost certain to be faced with a bloody war?
No, but there's not one man, one vote anywhere in
because
Africa.
20 million black people in your country wish to have the vote.
No, but you see, your problem is, it is no use. You keep on arguing about 20 million blacks.
Will there be one man, one vote?
Certainly. That is inevitable. There will be a one man, one vote in this country. And there will be a majority government in this country. But that majority government will accommodate everybody.
Led by?
Mandela.
Free Nelson Mandela.
Is prisoner number 220/82. And he writes, "My darling mum,
I often wonder just how far more difficult it would have been for me to take the decision to leave you behind if I had been able to see clearly the countless perils and hardships to which you would be exposed in my absence. Your love and support, the raw warmth of your body, is what life and happiness means to me. I love you, devotedly, Madiba.
After 7 years of banishment, Winnie defied the government and tried to return home to Soweto.
Don't drag me. I know what the rest means. What do you think you're doing? Don't push me.
Winnie came out of her banishment and she took over these young people as if they were her own children. And there in her Orlando home, there were some rooms at the back and they were living there. And they were an obnoxious lot, there's no doubt about it. But as far as Winnie is concerned, they were her children and they could do no wrong.
I am back with you where I belong. This is now the right time to take your country. We have no arms. We have stones. We have boxes of matches. We have copper.
Circumstances under which you would talk with and release Nelson Mandela?
I'm only prepared to talk to people who want constitutional change, but I'm not prepared to talk to people who want revolutionary change.
Botha offered to release Mandela if he renounced the ANC and the armed struggle.
My father says, I have always been a member of the African National Congress. And I will remain a member of the African National Congress until the day I die. I cannot and will not give any undertaking at a time when I and you, the people, are not free. Your freedom and mine cannot be separated.
We need Nelson Mandela. That is our leader. That is our leader. Release our leader.
I've been lenient and patient. Don't push us too far. Don't push us too far.
Might be possible.
Unfortunately, the obstacles still exist. As I have pointed out, the onus is on Mr. de Klerk. As far as the family is concerned, we are back to where we have to pressure for his release once more.
The prohibition of the African National Congress, the Pan-Africanist Congress, the South African Communist Party, and a number of subsidiary organizations is being rescinded. I wish to put it plainly that the government has taken a firm decision to release Mr. Mandela unconditionally.
Father of
that I'm back, I have the opportunity to concern myself with my wife and to try and assure her that her problems will now be shared by both of us.
Months after the release of her husband, Winnie Mandela was charged with assault, kidnapping, and murder. 2 years earlier, Stompie Moeketsi, a 14-year-old political activist, had been abducted by her bodyguards and brought to her home. He was found later with his throat slit.
That's 516-620-3602. Now, we gave you a nice hefty chunk of this, and I was very happy that we were able to include that seminal picture that it's one of the pictures, you know. I suppose that sometime at the end of your life, there are some pictures that are burned into your as a sort of template into your mind's eye. And I imagine that they're there forever. And sometime at the end of your life, these are some of the last pictures that you have. And one of those pictures, I suspect, when the time comes for me, is probably going to be that picture of Mandela being released from prison. Maybe it was because I was a lot younger than I am now, obviously. Not a youth, not a child, and certainly not very impressionable. But yet, there's something about that image of him coming out of prison and, you know, holding aloft, a clenched fist and, you know, that Amandla thing. And they were, and all of these tens and hundreds of thousands of people who gathered in this arena where he spoke. And it was a moment of such remarkable and transcendental human triumph. And the thing that I struggle with is the fact that these are people I don't know, I've never met, I've never been to their country, but somehow this was an international moment that galvanized the spirit of you, the collective spirit of humanity, in a way that transcended borders and geography, and I guess it hit us at the thing that we share in our most fundamental humanness, whatever that thing is. I think that is what it appealed to. That is what resonated then, and that is what resonates now. So anyway, all that to say that this remarkable documentary, and as you can tell, the story continues. The documentary is 2 hours long. It's a full-length documentary film, Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation. This Friday, May 10th, marks the 19th anniversary of Mandela's accession to the presidency of South Africa. Mandela was released from prison on February 11th of 1990, and it was not until May 10th of 1994 that he acceded to the presidency. So this documentary continues to cover that four-year period, all of what went into the negotiations during that period, the dismantling the structures of apartheid and replacing the apartheid laws with new laws and different regulations, negotiating the terms of electioneering in a multiracial election in a country that until that moment had only known a mandatory, legally required and enforced separation of the races. How do you navigate that territory? In fact, as has been pointed out, some of the most difficult challenges in Mandela's life lay ahead of him once he was released from prison. I had started by reading a paragraph from the booklet that comes along with this package. A paragraph that said that Mandela, let's see, though he left jail both an icon and international celebrity, Mandela knew that the hardest fight of his life was only just beginning. He still had to lead South Africa's black community to victory as the ruling white minority at last bowed to the inevitable change. He also had to ensure that there was a peaceful transfer of power and use all his political skills to stop the country plunging into civil war as various groups, some of them in fact black, tried to stop the elections that would lead to the ANC taking over. In doing so, in confronting all of these challenges, Mandela would demonstrate the qualities that he had developed during those long years in prison. Among them, a refusal to ever give up and to ever give in, a refusal that was matched by a quite extraordinary understanding and forgiveness for his opponents. That forgiveness of his opponents is one of the aspects of Mandela's life that I still struggle with. Most people I know, I think, would have great difficulty. When you take 27 years out of a person's life, how do you, how does that, when someone takes 27 years of your life away from you, and remember, when you go into this, you don't know that you're coming out after 27 years. So with the benefit of hindsight, we can now say that these people took away 27 years of his life by having him incarcerated for standing up for what he knew to be a righteous principle, which is the humanity of all people. But when you're going into this, you don't know that you'll be there for 27 years. So there's no way to measure this experience against some eventual end point or culmination of this process. You're just in there every day knowing that you're going to be in there conceivably until the end of your life, whenever that time comes. So when the time does come and you are released from prison and you're now, what, 72 years old? Remember this. This is in 1990. He is born in 1918. He is now 72 years old when he's released from prison. This is a time when many people are quite, in developing countries, are quite frankly preparing to die, including many people in the developed world who do not have the kind of first world 1% healthcare and lifestyle that some people are able to enjoy, and that can keep some people alive well into their 90s and beyond. So when you're released from prison at 72 years old, this is the time when most people are preparing to retire if they have not yet retired, and they're beginning to get their affairs in order and figure out, well, what am I going to do for the next 10, 15, maybe 20 years of my life if I'm really lucky. How am I going to spend that time? This is now after my active life period. Well, in this case, Mandela's new life is now beginning, and these monumental challenges are now ahead of him at that age and stage in life. Mandela was to emerge as a unique figure on the world stage, for which he was seen not just as a politician who could be trusted, but as an international statesman and with an unmatched moral authority. So, the documentary film on DVD, together with the audio CD of the soundtrack, together with the beautiful 46-page booklet, including a narrative on the life of Mandela, and every page is chock full of full-color photographs, as well as archival black and white photographs of highlights in Mandela's life. So the DVD of the documentary film, plus the audio CD of the soundtrack, plus the special 46-page booklet, the full-color booklet, plus the special National Geographic map issued, especially issued for this purpose, for this particular project on the life of Nelson Mandela, the map by National Geographic, 21 inches by 30 inches. All of that is available in a single package called Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation. And that complete package is available to you this afternoon as a thank you gift with your pledge at the $100 level. And the number to call is 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Now, I said that I would have liked us to walk out of here this afternoon with a minimum of 100 of your pledges under our belt. I think Frankly, I think it is still possible. And here's why. Even though we're only 7 minutes away from the top of the hour, here's why. Because over at the call center at 516-620-3602, they can take, you know, 12, 15, 20 of your calls all at once. So we can do this quite easily. If we get a flurry right now of 25 calls, we can do this. But we need to get that flurry of 25 calls right now. That means your call and 25 others. If we can get those 25 calls right now within the next 7 minutes, within the next 5, 6, 7 minutes, if we can do that, and of course we can do that, there, you know, just think of this, of the number of people who are listening to us right now. So if we can get those 25 calls, your call, a flurry, that's what we're looking for, of your call and 24 others at 516-620-3602. If we can get that done, if we can get that right now, then we can do that. To the number 516-620-3602. Remember that you can make your pledge at any level that is comfortable and convenient for you. You're 25, 35, 50, 65, 70, 75, you're $85 pledge, you're $100, $500, $5,000 pledge, you're $1,500 pledge, whatever works for you. You know, and at the $100 pledge level, we'll send you that package. Just ask for the Mandela set. Okay, that's all you have to ask for. It's the only thing we're offering on the program right now, the Mandela set. So you ask for the Mandela set, which includes the DVD, the CD, the booklet, and the map. Okay? Oh, here's more Vasco da Gama. Here's more of Hugh Masekela. A bit of dialing music as we approach the top of the hour. Mr. Michael G. Haskins, what an afternoon it's been on this opening day.
Oh, my goodness, Hugh. I am so filled with confidence. Filled with confidence because the listeners are always coming through for this radio station, are always coming through for this program. Look at here. Hold on one second. Who do we have? We have Thomas Gordon called in with a pledge of support.
Thank you, Thomas
Talk
Gordon.
Back with Hugh Hamilton this afternoon. Joy DeKeeley called in.
Thank you.
Larry Hughes, Derek Thompson, Thomas Bird, Norma Belvet. Gulam Chowdhury called in. Loretta Rose called in. There are others who have called in who are calling in right now to WBAI.
Thank you, thank you, and thank you again.
Supporting this radio station, letting everyone know that you have the back of TalkBack, that you have the back of WBAI. You're going to help us get through our issues and come out on the other side stronger. The number for you to call right now, the number for you to call with your pledge of support to WBAI, supporting TalkBack, is 516-620-3602. It's 516-620-3602. It's a tax-deductible contribution to this radio station and supporting this program. You are wonderful. Thank you very much for continuing to believe in this radio station. Thank you so very much. Please continue to call.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you again. Please keep these coming. Just got a very nice word here from Kathy Davis, who is monitoring the situation there over with the call center. And thank you very much. I think we're on a roll, and we can hit that 100 mark. Just keep these calls coming, okay? Just keep them coming. And thank you so much for being so generous, for being so supportive. You know, we have arguably the best job in the world. You know, we get to bring information here. We get to, as I often say, anybody can tell you what the news is. You come here to find out what it means and why it matters. That's what we do on TalkBack. And then from time to time, we do these long-form presentations during these fundraising drives. And you show your support. You deliver every time, and it is such a heartwarming and wonderful thing. I cannot thank you enough. On behalf of my colleague Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer and director of incidental music, please keep these calls coming. The number again, 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Stand by for the WBAI Evening News coming up at the top of the hour. I I'm Hugh Hamilton. You'll find us on Facebook under my name, and it would be lovely if you could check us out on Facebook. Look for our page under my name, Hugh Hamilton, and if you have not yet done so, we'd love it if you'd like us. And I shall see you again on Monday. I look forward to seeing you then. Thank you, and thank you again. The good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
Please don't stop calling. There's still time. And even after 6 o'clock, after the evening news comes your way, there's still time to call. There's still time to pledge your support, to make a financial contribution to keep this radio station going, to keep this radio station moving forward. Supporting Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton, that number, 516-620-3602. If you're driving now and cannot use your phone, and of course you can't do that, but what you can do is when you get home, when you get to your location, wherever that might be, you can log on to the website WBAI.org or give to, that's the number two, give to WBAI.org. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale of WBAI's Tuesday evening environmental show, Ecologic. One of the cool things about being a BAI buddy is that you get to decide what WBAI is worth to you. Are we worth more than your cable TV? Or 10 bucks a month? 20, 100, a million? Just go to the WBAI.org website and sign up with your credit card. You'll barely notice it. In return, you get a WBAI tote bag to show off, free or discounted entry to special WBAI events, and other perks. Another cool thing about being a BAI buddy is less fundraising interruptions to your favorite programs. Go to WBAI.org. You can donate in the name of your favorite show, like Ecologic.
And do you know that another perk of becoming a WBAI buddy during this fun drive, our spring fun drive that continues relentlessly on through the coming Memorial Day weekend and on and on. But if you become a buddy between now and June 8th, you will also receive a subscription to The Nation magazine delivered weekly to your home in addition to the member perks and the WBAI buddy bag. So what better time to contribute as little as $10 a month? That's $120 a year. More if you can afford it. $12, $15 a month, whatever you would like removed from whatever bank account you tell us. Become a WBAI buddy and get a subscription to The Nation magazine at the same time. One of the perks of membership of WBAI. Coming up in a moment will be Democracy Now! And following that, why programming so fantastic and incredible, two words that probably shouldn't be used to describe fundraising programming. But that's what's coming up here on WBAI New York in our overnight at 5 a.m. An hour of national and international news from Free Speech Radio News and Al Jazeera English. And at 6 a.m., I got to look at the schedule. I don't know what's coming up at 6 a.m. Democracy Now! In a moment. Please stay tuned to WBAI New York.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover.
This is Saul Williams.
And this is Michael French from Spearhead.
And this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
This is Reverend Jesse Jackson of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Please call and support WBAI, non-commercial, peace and justice radio in New York.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin.
The issue is maleness.
men. What are men about? What do we understand about ourselves? What do other people understand about us? Men like to make believe they know everything they're doing, but you know, the truth is most of us have no idea what we're doing. On Thursday, May 23rd, from 1 to 3 p.m., a special edition of The Positive Mind dedicated to understanding men. Be sure to tune in Thursday, May 23rd, from 1 to 3 p.m. here on WBAI 99.5 FM.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we turn right now to a new documentary called Shadows of Liberty. It's a documentary that was produced by Doc Factory and Jean-Philippe Tremblay, a Canadian filmmaker. And I don't think I have to say much more about it. It speaks for itself. Shadows of Liberty.
Dollars have turned them into digital dollars. Has anybody got any good answers there?
Also good to know, I think I remember reading the Roeblings built the Brooklyn Bridge 125 years ago.
In this country, the most powerful country on earth, it is so actually difficult to get information, especially outside our borders, not to mention what's going on inside this country.
About 4 hours and 20 minutes ago at 9:42 p.m. Eastern time, that would have put it at 5.
Public information, the news we rely on to learn about what's happening in the world, to learn about one another, is in the hands, basically, of commercial enterprises.
Says an agreement on health care is close, but support could
still crumble. Giant media corporations like Time Warner, News Corporation, Disney, and so forth, they get to decide what is news, what is newsworthy, and what is not newsworthy.
This is America. How many of you people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgage?
What the press is pushing is distortions, lies, lack of balance.
I have 900 channels on my TV, but 700 of them are so
news. So many great celebrity stories. Thank God.
Oh, look at that. She's
that's
so
a reformed woman.
Yeah.
This evening we have a lot of news to tell you about Anna Nicole Smith, who died in Florida.
We have a commercially driven journalism that has no interest in poor people, but they're basically written out of the picture altogether. And we have a system that tells us what people in power are interested in, what they want to talk about.
When was the last time, Governor, that you were at a Wendy's and had a Frosty? And you ordered
make no mistake about it. Is to control people's ideas, is to control their imagination.
Also reminded him that the channel was part of the establishment, so he must conduct himself accordingly.
Executives to put on positive stories.
You have pressure from news executives to put on positive stories.
They wouldn't say it in that way, but they would edit my pieces. They would push me in different directions. They would turn down stories that were more critical.
We're in a profound crisis of democracy. You can't choke off discourse and have a free society.
This is what you get with corporate media. It's gonna
These happen. Are stories you will not be told on radio, in newspapers, or on television. A clash between two worlds. Big media corporations spinning public perception for profit versus the defenders of truth who stand for liberty and democracy.
And that's our news for tonight.
Been asked if there was any pressure on me because of the kinds of stories that I do. I was always asked, are there some stories that you can't do? Are there some times that you're not allowed to report on certain things because of advertisers? And my answer was always, absolutely not.
Decades after the end of the Vietnam War, the United States lifted the trade embargo against Vietnam. And CBS chief correspondent Roberta Baskin looked into one corporation's search for cheaper labor markets.
The premise for the story was the fact that Nike were subcontracting to these factories on the other side of the planet, but they weren't really taking responsibility for how the shoes were made. And I asked to follow the trail.
In August of 1996, Baskin and a CBS News film crew flew to Vietnam to investigate the Nike factories.
We were able to kind of peek through the keyhole, but we were not allowed inside. We were barred.
As Baskin waited outside the factory gates, what she heard from the workers would forever change her views on Nike.
One of the things that really shocked me was to discover that the word Nike had become a verb. The word Nike meant to abuse your employees. There were incidences of physical abuse. Women who had their mouths taped shut for talking on the line. 15 women were systematically hit with the top part of a Nike shoe around the face and the neck. It was this disparity between seeing the corporate image that the company sells and the reality in these factories. Just do it, or else.
Roberta Baskin's news report about Nike abuses was broadcast on CBS News television across the United States.
CBS was very pleased submitting it for prestigious awards. For me, what was really exciting about it was that the phones rang off the hook. There was picketing of Nike towns across the country. There were boycotts that were being organized by students on campuses. I realized that it had touched some kind of a nerve.
Nike's labor abuses reached the media, and the shoe giant came forward to limit the damages.
We don't have abusive labor conditions in our factories, and really never have.
With Nike in denial, CBS News commissioned Baskin to do a follow-up investigation, working with a Vietnamese labor group.
Roberta's work was mainly about the corporate punishment. We help add another dimension to the problems that the wages and excessive amount of overtime. Nike's not the good guys, even though they've done a lot of commercials saying they are, but people at that moment realized that they are not part of the good team.
As Baskin was putting together the updated news report on Nike's labor practices, she received unexpected news from inside CBS.
I got a call from my executive producer who said the story is not going to air. It's been taken off schedule. There's some sort of deal being made between Nike and CBS News for the upcoming Winter Olympics. The air went out of my soul.
CBS News was paying an enormous amount of money for the rights. And so by definition, they would be seeking out commercial sponsors who would pour lots of money into it so that they could recoup the millions that they were paying for the rights of the Olympics.
The 18th Olympic Winter Games on CBS.
As CBS revealed their Olympic coverage, the deal between Nike and CBS was plain to see.
Correspondent after correspondent are wearing these Nike jackets on the air, with a little CBS something or other, you really couldn't read it, and a big swoosh on the shoulder. That was the deal. Nike had convinced CBS News to turn its correspondents into billboards. It was heartbreaking.
The CBS News correspondents were furious. They had to wear the Nike parkas whenever they appeared on air. It's just not done.
Baskin wrote a memo requesting CBS management to take the Nike logo off the correspondents.
CBS had crossed this incredible line. How do you trust serious stories when you're seeing the reporter wearing a bunch of logos? Immediately, the president of CBS News responded, saying this was a breach of professional etiquette. It meant that I should shut up. How dare I raise a question about the integrity of CBS News?
After questioning the deal with Nike, Baskin was removed from her position as the chief correspondent of CBS News.
It wasn't an ordinary transfer, a change. It was a demotion. And it was a demotion that it was to send a message.
I ended up asking if I could get out of my contract. The president responded, great. They were, you know, happy to see me go.
Hi, Mr. Sautery. I'm Roberta Baskin from CBS News.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you about...
To this day, the CBS network has buried both of Baskin's reports on the Nike sweatshops.
These are the kind of fundamental conflicts of interest that result in censorship, that result in a narrow debate, and they come directly from the fact that we've made these historical choices to allow corporations to own and control our media.
Media today is dominated by a handful of corporations. This is a far cry from the original ideals of the country. As Americans fought for independence from imperial rule, the revolution found its inspiration in an unexpected place.
The United States was in many senses founded by a journalist, Tom Paine, who called Americans to revolution against a British Empire that was thought to be completely unbeatable. This country was really founded on the concept that if you gave citizens the information they needed, they could govern themselves.
The founders of the United States gave citizens the fundamental right to a free press.
A revolution for freedom of information.
One of the primary reasons for freedom of the press was that it was the only way people outside of power could keep the government from becoming an empire. Stop militarism, stop the corruption, the secrecy, and the cronyism. That was the function of freedom of the press.
There's a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution. Because we're supposed to be holding those in power accountable, asking the critical questions.
One of the first steps of the new government was to encourage the distribution of independent news through subsidies.
This was actually America's revolutionary contribution. The genius of the subsidies is that it did not discriminate against the content of the newspapers.
The abolitionist movement didn't start in Congress. It started in those freely distributed weekly newspapers. And that was really where we began to address the most fundamental sins of the American experiment.
It's simply information that is power. It's information that frees us, because when people get information, they then can decide what to do.
Today, the founding vision of America's journalistic independence has become deeply distorted.
Media is the conversation we have as a society. It's the way we learn about the world. It's the way we learn about one another. We see the range of public debate constrained because there may be many things that citizens of a democratic society need to know about that private corporations may not be interested in telling them.
One of the biggest news stories of the 1980s was the explosion of crack cocaine in the United States.
Police, freeze! It's another night, another